from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Scientists in both the Netherlands and the United States have figured out how to create a version of the bird flu virus that would make it much more transmittable in humans. Why do that kind of research? Well, one reason is that it yields the kind of information that could help scientists develop a vaccine. The research was about to be published when a government advisory board stepped in and asked two scientific journals to halt publication for fear that making that information available would be ready-made for bioterrorists. Should that research be published, or are the dangers of publication too great? We'll hear from leading scientists and take your calls after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The editors of Science and Nature magazines were faced with a tough dilemma. Should they publish a research paper that showed how the deadly bird flu virus could be made more readily transmittable in humans? In the right hands, the research could help scientists develop a bird flu vaccine. But a government advisory board was worried about what would happen if the research wound up in the wrong hands, that it could give potential bioterrorists the ability to start a deadly epidemic. And so the advisory board did something that's never been done before. It asked the magazines to hold off publishing the details of the research. And so they did, for now. As Dr. Bruce Alberts, the editor of Science magazine, put it, it's a precedent-setting moment, and we need to be careful about the precedent we set. Is holding back the details of the bird flu research the right move, or will it slow down legitimate scientific research? It's a classic risk versus benefit dilemma, and it's the one we take up in this hour of Forum. Joining us to do so, Bruce Alberts. He is editor-in-chief of Science, one of two scientific journals asked by the United States government not to publish the full details of the bird flu research. Dr. Alberts, good morning.
Good morning.
Joining us, too, is Hank Greeley. He is director of the Center for Law and Biosciences and a law professor at the Stanford University Law School. Hank Greeley, good morning as well.
Happy to be here.
And joining us by telephone this morning from the Bethesda, Maryland vicinity, Anthony Fauci. He is director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the NIH, which sponsored the research. Dr. Fauci, thanks for being with us as well.
It's good to be with you.
Why don't you start us out, Dr. Fauci, by telling us more about this research. First, the why of it. Why would you want to sponsor research that would lead to creating a form of the bird flu virus that would make it more transmittable?
Well, you have to take it into the context of what's going on out literally in the environment. As many people know, but just to remind people that in 1997, there emerged in Southeast Asia what was referred to as the bird flu. It was H1N1. It went under the radar screen for a couple of years, then came back in 2003. It's a kind of influenza that's fundamentally an influenza of birds, particularly chicken. It decimates chicken flocks and rarely spreads from chickens to humans, and even more rarely, with very, very few exceptions, goes from human to human. That's the good news. The bad news is that in humans, when they do get infected, it is highly lethal. There have only been about 600 infections, and there have been more than 50% of the individuals have died. So it doesn't have the transmissibility capability that normal seasonal flu have, where it spreads easily from person to person, but it's highly lethal.
Which makes it sort of counterintuitive, in a sense, to sponsor research that would make it more transmissible.
No. The research is done to help the public health effort to prevent that from happening. So let's go on and talk about what the reason for doing the research is that officials in Indonesia and in Vietnam and in other areas in Southeast Asia are very concerned locally because of the threat that this virus, which easily mutates, and we know that influenza viruses do that, will in fact mutate to be able to maintain its lethality at the same time that it acquires the ability to be transmitted more efficiently. And they're very concerned about that, and they want to know what it is that we need to look for that might even hint that this would happen. What about the vaccines that we already made back several years ago against the H5N1? Would it work against such a virus? What about the drugs that we use? So there are legitimate scientific questions to be asked.
Sort of staying a step ahead.
Exactly. So what the researchers have done was to determine a couple of things. First of all, in a mammalian species, and the ferret is the best model, not a perfect model, but a best model for influenza in humans. And the question is, if you take this H5N1 bird flu that's still smoldering in the environment in Southeast Asia predominantly and still threatening, that it might emerge in a more transmissible way, the research asks a couple of questions. First of all, is it even possible for this virus to do that? And if it does that, what are the characteristics of that virus that we may make available to people who are out there doing the surveillance so that they can anticipate that they may be getting closer to the emergence of this virus that might do an awful lot of harm throughout the world and particularly in that region? So the purpose of the research was, under very careful conditions and contained conditions, to do the experiments, to take a look at what a virus like that would look like, to alert people to be on the, as you say, one step ahead of the virus, and also to prepare, if necessary, to see if the vaccines that we have work and the drugs that we have work. So the legitimacy of doing the experiment is very clear. However, what was found out is that it was easier to have a virus, if you do the right mutations and passage it in these animals, to acquire this ability to transmit well. And once those results became apparent, the results were put before the National Science Advisory Board for Biosecurity, which is a advisory board to the federal government and to different agencies within the government, to ask, you know, what really should we do with this information? Should it be published just the way it is? And the journal editors, Bruce Alberts among them, among the two, Bruce being the editor-in-chief of Science, we're faced with the question, what should we do with the information? Should we publish it in its entirety so that everyone could have access to it, which is the danger that someone who wants to use it for nefarious purposes would use it? But we also want to get it into the hands of people who really do need the information, both
right,
for surveillance as well as for research. And that's the dilemma now.
Well, let me hold you there, if I might, Dr. Fauci, with that dilemma and bring it over to Dr. Alberts, editor-in-chief of Science magazine, because that's precisely what you were faced with.
You're still faced with this dilemma. That's right. It's been going on for months. This is an unprecedented action by the advisory board. I want to stress that this advisory board was set up shortly after 9/11 at the advice of the National Academy of Sciences, and it's the right group to make this kind of decision. It has outstanding scientists on it, as well as people from the security field with that kind of expertise. And it's obviously been very conservative in making this kind of a recommendation, because it's been in existence for 7 years, and this is the first time it's decided to suppress any information. All other papers looked at have been released as they were. I also want to make the point that the journals are not simply waiting around to hear if somebody catches them, you know, like the NSABB. I want to ensure the public that we're very well aware of these possibilities. And the first thing we did when we got this paper, we alerted ourselves through our editors, and we sent the paper out for two kinds of review. One was the scientific review we always do. Is this good science? Is it reproducible? Is all the data shown? But the other kind of review, which is very unusual, we sent it to experts in biosecurity. And so through that pathway, it was obvious that the NSABB was going to find out about it, we hope, because some of the people we sent it to were on the NSABB. The
and scientists. Again, that's the advisory board.
That's right. And then we heard that we should wait because the NSABB was going to make a decision.
And yet your inclination must have been, as a publisher and editor, to publish. Make the argument for that. If you hadn't gotten this sort of red light stop sign from the advisory board, why should this kind of information, which does seem potentially dangerous, be available?
Well, this was the traditional do-use dilemma, and this is why the advisory board was set up. I mean, making this kind of information widely available will get it in the hands of people who otherwise wouldn't see it, people who are trying to protect public health, because we don't know everybody who needs to know. Having more eyes on this always makes it more likely that the science will advance in the ways you want. Better understanding of what could happen when this virus mutates and better tools to counteract it. On the other hand, we know that this is not trivial to do, but we know that terrorist groups have been recruiting microbiologists and so on, and we don't want to tell them the exact recipe of how to do this. And so that balance is exactly what the NSABB struggled with for a long time, over a month, before coming down the way they did.
And so you're on hold for now.
That's right. We're on hold.
Hank Greeley, ethicist, as someone who looks into these at the Center for Law and Biosciences at Stanford, what strikes you about the dilemma and how you go about assessing this business of risk versus benefit?
You know, there are questions that are hard in lots of different ways, and this is a genuinely hard question, which, like all genuinely hard questions, involves the collision of two equally strong principles. On the one hand, science needs to be openly discussed in order for it to be good and in order for it to do well in the world. On the other hand, we have to worry about security. Those two principles are in conflict here. You could go with an extreme position in either direction. You could turn this into something like nuclear weapons and try to classify all of it. That would be extremely hard to do given the breadth of biology and the amount of biology being done over the world, and would be, frankly, a disaster for the science. You could also go to the other extreme and say nobody should tell anybody, make any recommendations to anybody about what not to publish, and take a strong First Amendment kind of absolutist position. And that works fine until the first terrorist outbreak is a result, in which case not only do people die, but science is deeply injured as well. What I like about the current plan is that the recommendation is not made by a government bureaucrat. It's made by a 25-person advisory board of good people. And second, it's a recommendation. It's not a requirement. Bruce could listen to it or not. I'm sure he would listen to it, but Bruce could decide to go along with it or not. And same with Phil Campbell, the editor-in-chief of Nature. And that balance means that it's not deeply satisfying as being all of one thing or all of another, but I think it gives us a better chance to muddle through.
And the possibilities, as I understand it, would be to publish some of the information, make some of the more detailed information available but only available to selected scientists. Is there a sort of continuum of possibilities that you're wrestling through, Dr. Alberts?
That's right. In fact, the advisory board wants us to publish quickly the general finding, which is it's very easy to produce this kind of dangerous virus, and we need to alert the world to be put more effective resources into protecting ourselves. So they're anxious to get this information out. They're also anxious. This is the sticking point right now. They're anxious to get the detailed information out after publication to the appropriate people who have a need to know. And the journals have insisted that we know what that plan is before we publish an abridged form of this manuscript.
And, of course, it must also be a problem to decide who the appropriate people are. I read the Dutch scientists, one of the two groups that did this, had 100 organizations in mind and 1,000 different scientists. So it can get pretty widespread quickly. Let's bring into our conversation now as well one other voice. That's Michael Spector, who is a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine, writes about science, technology, and the public health. Michael Spector, where do you come down on this argument? Are you an advocate for putting that information out there?
Well, I think the first thing I have to say is I, oddly enough, agree with most of what's been said already. I'm not, you know, I don't think the WikiLeaks approach is helpful. I don't think that the First Amendment is the only amendment that matters. And I think it's really thoughtful that they didn't try to censor this information but made a recommendation. And I think it's thoughtful that people are discussing it. Having said all that, I don't think it makes sense to withhold information from the people who can actually use it intelligently for the reason that terrorists are recruiting microbiologists. Because terrorists who recruit microbiologists and microbiologists who are sophisticated enough to want to kill us in all sorts of ways can do a hell of a better job than by worrying about manipulating H5N1. there, you can go buy anthrax. I mean, I don't want to recite. You can go on the internet and you can download all sorts of recipes, including one for polio. And people can make that, and they can send it out. And if people want to kill us, they can kill us. So the idea that the people who we don't want to have exposed to this are the very scientists who can do something about it. And again, as these guys know better than I, science isn't a linear thing. Just getting it out there isn't a recipe. It allows people to do some experiments that may lead us into directions that we need to be led.
Michael Spector, staff writer for The New Yorker. Anthony Fauci, what do you make of Mr. Spector's argument that there are so many other things that could be done more readily than this that you could find, any of us could find on the internet, so it doesn't make much sense to try to keep this particular recipe bottled up?
Well, I partially agree with Michael. I usually agree with him most of the time, but I think I want to interject a bit of information in the deliberations of the NSABB that might clarify the point that Michael was trying to make about the difference between doing something that's really easy like anthrax, because it's out there, rather than trying to manipulate an influenza virus to give it greater transmissibility. That's a good point, but on the other side of the coin, the thing that triggered the concern on the part of the NSABB,
and again,
that's the National Science Advisory Board for Biosecurity, yeah, the one who made the recommendations that we're discussing right now. The thing that triggered the concern and was the basis of their recommendation, that if successful, if in fact a person with nefarious purposes is successful in doing that, this is very different from anthrax, because anthrax doesn't spread from person to person. You can get an anthrax attack, put it in a ventilation system of a subway and kill X number of people, very limited number. If you get a 50 to 60% lethal influenza that spreads the way seasonal influenza spreads, that's really a catastrophe. Yeah. Now, it's much, much more difficult to do that than it is to grow up some anthrax. But the effect on morbidity and mortality is profound.
You're in a kind of interesting, ironic situation in some ways, it occurs to me, Dr. Fauci, at the NIH, I mean this broadly, that you funded and supported this research and are now in the position as the people who oversee the National Scientific Advisory Board for Biosecurity of saying, well, let's keep that under wraps.
Well, see, I think we need to clarify. Remember, we don't oversee a board. And I think this was made in just a few moments ago, this point that this is not a bureaucratic group of people who report to bureaucrats and have binding types of mandates. This is an independent advisory committee made up of highly qualified scientists that give advice to the government and to the journals and to others. So we are the home where they sit, in the sense of a place where they can deliberate, but their recommendations are independent of influence from the federal government.
Hank Gradley, is this something that could have been thought through more? I mean, it sounds from what Dr. Fauci is describing that they discovered that this was easier to do than they thought, and that's why they need to sort of come back again and take this more cautious view. But when you're wrestling with these risk versus benefit arguments, do you have to sort of think through those potential consequences before you get into the lab?
That's certainly helpful, but you can also think too far ahead and tie yourself down to paths that may not actually fit the facts as they come up. I think people aren't really remembering the history of this. The NSABB was set up in 2004. There had been several, at least three articles published in the scientific literature in the preceding 3 or 4 years that had raised these kinds of concerns. The National Academy of Sciences came out with a very long and good report on how to deal with it. A lot of thought had gone into this system. It turns out that thought hadn't gone through to all the details of it. So the issues that Bruce Alberts raises about how to figure out who should get the information, how to get that information to them, that hasn't been fully fleshed out yet, in part because, kind of surprisingly, in this almost 7 years the board has been in existence, this is the first time, as far as I know, they've recommended any limitations on publication. So, yes, it's good to think through things well in advance. A lot of this had been thought through. All of it, but not all of it, has been thought through. And it's good that we're actually getting a chance to kick the tires and take the test drive and see how the process works.
Dr. Albers.
That's the point. I mean, now that we have a precedent-setting example, we have to be very careful about how we do this, and it will be a learning experience. My experience, we never do anything perfectly the first time in life, and we're going to try to get it right. The government's working right now, and Dr. Fauci's intimately involved with this, and trying to make guidelines for who should get it and how to control the information. We're waiting for that before we publish. We will learn a great deal from what happens downstream in the next couple of years, and I would assume that the next time we'll be better prepared. We'll have a better mechanism.
So what do you envision as a possible next step, Bruce Albers? Would it be to publish something in the journal that sort of gives the kind of broad sweep of the research but not the details, and the appendix with all the details just goes to the select few?
That's right. In fact, both journals have already prepared versions. And I should say that this is very important. The advisory board left it up to the journals to decide what exactly should be left out and what is in. They gave us general guidance, but not the kind of detailed line-by-line kind of treatment you'd get from other kinds of agencies.
Bruce Albers, editor-in-chief of Science Magazine. Michael Spector, back to you at The New Yorker. Does that make that approach satisfy you, that there would be this kind of plan A and plan B for how the information would be disseminated?
It doesn't satisfy me, but I want to say, before I say why, that I think it's probably the best approach a government could come up with. But I have a couple concerns, and the second one I'll say first, which is the idea that an appendix full of details would go out to some scientists but not to the wider public. I am by far the best, far from the best reporter or even the best science reporter in this country, and I'll bet that once that appendix goes out, I can have it on my computer in a PDF within 6 hours. And if I can, so can other people.
Yeah.
So, yes, it will be harder to obtain the information, but the idea that somehow this will restrict information and accomplish what people want to accomplish, I think is nice, but it's naive. And I think there's a bigger concern, and it's a concern that I learned from many years of studying what Dr. Fauci has said to me. And that is, and it's very clear, pandemics come. Nature is the biggest bioterrorist we probably have to worry about. And we don't seem to care about that. The flu of a couple years ago was surprisingly mild. It didn't kill as many people as flu usually kills in the United States. But we were just lucky. It could have killed millions. Americans don't care. 30 to 40% of them say they don't even want to be bothered getting a flu shot. And I think the more we can do to get information out there that this is a serious threat and really statistically a way more serious threat than anything having to do with any bioterrorist that exists is something that is really incumbent upon, at least upon me as a journalist. And I think upon the government as well.
Michael Spector, staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, posing the dilemma that we are currently faced with, that Bruce Albers at Science Magazine in particular is faced with. How do you weigh these difficult questions of the dangers involved versus the possibility that getting that information out there is necessary for science in order to prepare for the possibilities? We'll take up that question when we return. We'd like to hear your thoughts on this. Should this kind of information be more widely disseminated, or should it be more restricted? You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. You can go to our Facebook page, add your thoughts there, or also to our website at kqed.org. We'll hear more from Dr. Anthony Fauci at the NIH, Bruce Albers, editor of Science Magazine, Hank Greeley at the Center for Law and Biosciences, and Michael Spector at The New Yorker magazine when we return. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the dilemma currently facing both Science and Nature magazines, and that is to whether or not to publish and in what detail should that information be published, about the fact that researchers have now discovered a way in which the bird flu virus, which in the past has been not very readily transmittable to humans, now can be. Should that information be out there, or should it just go to a select number of scientists who might be able to work good work with that to create perhaps a vaccine or to be able to spot environmental changes that would lead to the bird flu becoming more transmittable? Should that information be out there? Do we need to keep it under wraps? That's the dilemma we're facing in our program this morning. We'd like to hear your thoughts on it, too. You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Anthony Fauci, before the break, Michael Spector was making the argument that this is an opportunity, actually, to get people to think about how serious these pandemics can be. And that's an argument for getting the information out there. You were sort of making the contrary argument to a degree, which was, yes, it is so serious. Therefore, we need to be very careful about how it's transmitted. How do you respond to Michael Spector's argument?
No, I think, if I might, Michael's argument was that the danger of a naturally occurring emerging pandemic is far, far greater than the danger of somebody deliberately perpetrating this on society, and therefore we should be paying a lot of attention to work that actually is aimed at helping to prevent and respond to these emerging, naturally emerging infections. And he used the word that I use very frequently in discussions, is that nature is the worst potential bioterrorist. So the reason we're doing the research that's dual-use research and creating this discussion is that we need to address how we can approach naturally emerging and re-emerging infection. So the stimulus for the research that happens to also, because it is dual use, have the potential for danger, the entire stimulus for that research is how we can best address the real worry, which is naturally occurring emerging and re-emerging infections.
Hank Greeley, what advice do you want to pass along to Bruce Alberts, sitting to your right this morning? If he needs a resident ethicist to provide guidance, what would that be?
Keep a good supply of antacids. I don't envy him his position or his colleague at or his competitor at Nature's position. I think these are hard questions. But listening to advice, and you know, I think from his perspective, one of the nice things the NSABB does is give him some outside expert advice and something he can listen to, react to, rely on or not as he chooses, but make the best call he can and try not to obsess over it too much, because no matter what you do, you'll be second-guessed in one direction or the other. I think Michael Spector's right. There's no way that any restrictions on the information will keep it 100% restricted. Information will leak out, but this is one of those many areas of life where you can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Making some steps forward, doing the best you can is the best we can do, and it will fall short of perfect. That's life.
Let's hear what some of our listeners are thinking about this topic this morning. Dick joins us first from Marathon, Florida this morning on the Sirius Satellite Network. Dick, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm wondering just how close we are to the day when somebody who's not a scientist might cook up something deadly pathogen in his bedroom and let it loose on the world. Almost like genetic hacking is an analogy to computer hacking.
Dick, thanks. Dr. Fauci, how hard is this to do, and how close are we to when something like that could be launched much more readily?
Well, I think the caller was asking, could somebody who doesn't have a scientific background, somebody who just, you know, reads it in the internet and does it, that would be extremely difficult, if not untenable, that would happen. The concern is people who might have some expertise in biology. I mean, things that could only be done by far advanced laboratories. The advances in biomedical research make it much less difficult for people with lesser degrees of training. And we always use the analogy saying that postdoctoral fellows now can manipulate the genes of viruses relatively easily that could only be done by very, very far advanced scientists who have great facilities at their disposal. But to have someone with no scientific background whatsoever click on the internet and look at the mutations that might be associated with increased transmissibility and make a deadly virus would really be almost out of the question.
Hank Greeley.
Yeah, I think that's right, but we are seeing more and more people with some scientific background getting interested in so-called do-it-yourself biology or synthetic biology. Synthetic biology isn't the same as do-it-yourself, but as synthetic biology becomes more and more common, the abilities to do things easily will increase, not to people with no biological background, but to people with an undergraduate degree or with some graduate training working in a garage. These possibilities exist. There's been a lot of discussion already, and I think the synthetic biology folks are to be applauded for worrying about these issues. But they are big issues, and they're going to get bigger as the technologies become easier for at least sophisticated people to use. They won't need the billion-dollar laboratories anymore.
How would you compare this to the case that I think is probably 30 years ago when I think it was the Progressive magazine published something on how to make an atom bomb?
I think this is scarier than that in a sense because in order to make an atom bomb, you need enriched uranium or you need plutonium. Those are not easy to get to. We noticed that it took Saddam Hussein a long time and a lot of effort, and he failed. The Iranians are still trying. That's a lot harder to do, I think, than some of these things. They've got the advantage of knowing that it can be done. Since it has been done, it can be done. We haven't seen that in this kind of biological warfare, except to the extent that, as Michael Spector and Anthony Fauci point out, nature does it to us all the time.
And Michael Spector, how do you come down on that point, on the sort of degree of difficulty factor and how that should govern what gets published and what doesn't?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, Tony and Hank are both completely right. I would say this, that newspapers and magazines all the time refrain from publishing information that they think will be damaging to people, to their countries, to the world. And they should do that. And it would be absolutely horrific if they didn't. And I'm really deeply respectful of the decisions these guys are making because they're not easy. My whole concern is that we could focus our attention in better ways and get a better bang for our thoughts. For one thing, the world is progressing in a way that, you know, I now have a phone that has more computing power than, most satellites had 20 years ago. That's happening with biology. We're all going to have equipment, tools, and abilities in a year, 10 years, 30 years that we didn't have before. And that is largely a wonderful thing. The downside is that people can do terrible things if they want. And I guess I always come down on the side of let's get that information out to people who are going to do the good things because they're 99.9% of the world.
And to Bill with our next caller comment from Chicago this morning. Bill, go ahead.
Thank you. Curious question for the panel. If I understand correctly, it wasn't just a discussion of how this was done, but what the counters would be to it as far as antiviruses that might be used or vaccines. My concern would be, could an enemy then reverse engineer and go, okay, this is what they're going to do to attack this virus, so if we design the virus to defeat the countermeasures, we've already got a leg up on them. And I thought the other purpose with a bioterror attack of this type would be to ensure that the outbreak gets detected too late to respond to it. So couldn't they now then use this research and go, if we make it masquerade like this or appear symptomatically to be like this, by the time they realize that they're on the wrong track entirely, we've already won. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Bill, thank you. Anthony Fauci.
Well, you know, anything is possible. So to say that no, that could not happen would just not be correct. But you have to understand what was done. A virus was developed by mutations and by serial passage in a ferret for the purpose of seeing if it could be transmissible. And then once it is transmissible, the question is asked, does a transmissible virus that's still lethal still have the characteristics of being protected by a vaccine that we have or sensitive to the drugs that we have? Certainly, if the virus got out into the hands of someone with nefarious purposes, that they would then say, well, maybe I want to change it so that it could be resistant to the drugs that we have or refractory to the vaccine. Sure, that's a possibility, but that's really a far stretch. I think that if someone with nefarious purposes wanted to release a virus that, in fact, could spread very, very well among humans with sustained lethality, they could cause enough damage by just releasing it without worrying about manipulating it. I also want to just interject to make sure everybody understands that although this virus now is has the capability of being transmissible among ferrets and lethal in ferrets, there isn't really a one-to-one direct relationship that, therefore, we know for sure that this would be transmissible in humans. So the reason the NSABB made their recommendations, because of the possibility that the virus that was developed in the ferret, because the ferret is the best model for human influenza, that it might also be actually, in reality, transmissible among humans. But we don't know that.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the National Institutes of Health. A couple of comments coming in from listeners on our website. Gerald writes, science doesn't work well without the free exchange of information. Besides that, labeling some research as too dangerous is as good as creating a something that says, here, look at this. Put this marker on it. It can make it, in fact, initially harder to get, but no security is permanent, and all research exists as part of that sort of universe. Another listener writes in, it's a very commonly believed fallacy that new technology can be kept secret. Once it's known that something is possible and perhaps not too difficult, then usually it does not take long for someone else to duplicate it. Michael Spector, I know you have to leave us in just a moment, so let me let you get a last comment in on that particular point, because that's part of what you were saying earlier, that within 6 hours you think you could find this, even if it were distributed in a more restricted way.
I do, and I'm not necessarily suggesting that. I mean, these guys have a point. And if I thought that they were right, and I thought that they could prevent the general distribution of this information to people who ought not have it, I'd jump in with both feet and say, this is the thing to do. In my experience, that just doesn't work out. The information gets out. It gets out no matter who's trying to prevent the release of it, in what country and under what circumstances. And I just think there's so many great scientists out there who care so much, many of them led by Dr. Fauci, that what we need is information. Information usually wins, and it usually does the right thing. There's one question I you may have discussed before I came on, and I just think it's really important, and we haven't touched on, and it's a little bit different, which is, should this kind of work be done in a higher security setting than was done? Because there is a higher security setting, and it's a much more complex issue. But, and I don't have a strong view. I don't know enough, but I'm sure Dr. Fauci does. And that, I think, is, you know, one of the concerns is not so much who will know about this, but can this stuff get out of a lab?
Michael Spector, again, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. Michael, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you. I'm sorry I have to leave. It's a really great and important topic.
Thank you. Let's pursue the question that he raises. Bruce Alberts, first on that, and then Dr. Anthony Fauci. Should this research, this kind of research, important to do, but done in a more restrictive way where the design is not so much for widespread scientific publication?
This is really a question for the NIH because, I mean, it could be done in a classified manner. There is work being done in the United States of that kind, and the decision was made not to do that. And I think Dr. Fauci is going to have to go through the logic there. I also wonder if when Dr. Fauci comes back on that issue, whether he could further explore Michael's point that basically the population is too passive about the possibility of a really terrible event happening naturally. Now they could worry also about it happening unnaturally. That may help us wake them up. But is there some way in which we could do better from the NIH perspective? And if so, how can we do so?
Let's hold on that point first. And if you would, before you get to that, Dr. Fauci, address Michael Spector's last point.
Well, yeah, there are two aspects to the idea of restricted research. One is to do it as classified research. In other words, nobody knows what you're doing, why you're doing it, and what the results are, except a very restricted group of people. The National Institutes of Health, which is the largest funder of biomedical research in the world, we don't do classified research. We do research with the fundamental principle of getting it out to people to replicate the research and to advance from the steps that are made, because that's what research is, knowledge in a step-by-step fashion. So that's one aspect of restriction. The other that I think Michael was referring to is the conditions in which it was done, in the sense of how do you protect the people who are doing the research? Is it done under the right secure facilities? And the answer to that question is that H5N1 is a select agent, which means that it has some clear-cut restrictions on safety and biosecurity when you work on them. You have to work in what's recalled biosafety level 3+, which is a very high level of biosafety and biosecurity. And the experiments were, in fact, conducted under the appropriate conditions because H5N1 is a select agent. The problem with classified research is that the classified research is not generally available at all to the biomedical research community to use to be able to help in a fundamental way the public and global health. And that's the entire purpose of the research that was done, to ultimately get out to the people who need to know it, the scientists, the public health officials, et cetera. So making it restricted or classified, as it were, which is the terminology that's used, would have almost inherently defeated the purpose of doing it at all.
Hank Greeley, on this question.
Yeah, I think classification is a disaster to be avoided as much as possible. It may be inevitable in some cases. We've certainly had classified biological defensive and, before the Nixon administration, offensive biological warfare research going on. As a very young man, I worked in the Carter administration, and I was appalled at what banal things were classified top secret. No one ever gets in trouble for classifying something that shouldn't be classified. Everyone worries about getting in trouble for not classifying something that is later proven to be dangerous or embarrassing. Classification is a metastatic disease, and it would it's terrible, I think, in general, but it's particularly bad for science, which relies so heavily on peer review, not just the peer review in advance of publication, but once something's published, your peers then tear it apart and see if they can replicate it and see if it makes sense. Classification avoids all that. So one of the things I like about the NSABB system is I view it as an alternative to classification and something that makes a classification system less likely to happen.
Before we get to this other question of creating more awareness about the dangers of these sorts of pandemics, Bruce Albers, just comment further on why it is important that there be – that science be done in the open, about why that is such a key part of the scientific journey.
Well, the whole success of science depends on its community aspects. It was a remarkable human invention when you think about it. You publish what you found, not only what you found, but all the details that will allow anybody else to do it, because that's the scientific agreement. We will not publish papers in the literature unless we're convinced that all the data is there and all the methods are there that would enable other scientists to check whether this is true. And so in return for all that disclosure, you get credit for some finding. You get some degree of honor if you've done something that's ingenious and useful. But the real aspect of science is that, you know, that one of my colleagues has defined science in two ways. There's a science with a small s. That's what everybody does. And then there's this incredible accumulation of credible knowledge that comes from the cooperative reproduction extension of what everybody else is. And that's, he calls that science with a capital S. And that's the knowledge base on which the world depends for all kinds of advances, health advances, technology advances, and everything else. And so the idea of restricting information, like the detailed methods used, In this case, which is part of the request, this is very much against the grain of what we do in science. But I just want to, you know, just in life, there's no absolutes. I mean, there's got to be some case in my mind, just logically, where the incredible thrust for openness is overwhelmed by some disadvantage. And according to the advisory panel, This is what's been reached here, and I have to trust their opinion because they spent a lot of time on this and they have the appropriate expertise.
Bruce Alberts, again, the editor-in-chief of Science Magazine. Let's turn now to this question that Michael Spector rose earlier and that we should come back to at this point, which is about there's great danger here, Anthony Fauci, in the possibility of pandemics, and we aren't paying a lot of attention to it. What more do you think ought to be done to create greater awareness and yet sort of take appropriate precautions so that that awareness and information doesn't get into the wrong hands?
Well, I think it's really getting the message out to the public as best as we can. I think the people who know of my own scientific interest, and most of the time when I'm out talking about the science that's associated with my institute, I absolutely emphasize and focus very heavily on the threat of emerging and re-emerging infectious diseases. If you just look at history, I mean, some people say, "Oh, you're just, crying wolf that something like this could happen." But if you just look at history measured in decades versus measured in months and years, you take a look at the fact that there have been a continual flow of emerging and re-emerging infectious diseases. That the only way that you can be prepared for it is to have the fundamental scientific basis, things that come from basic research that lead you to pathways that you couldn't have predicted, as well as directed research such as making vaccines that might be used for a variety of microbes, having antivirals and antimicrobials, etc. We talk about this all the time, but unfortunately, the public doesn't necessarily get attuned to threats that have not already happened. They tend to think about threats in the future as something else to worry about when it occurs. But the nature of emerging and re-emerging infections is that they come along unexpectedly and virtually out of nowhere. That's what happened in our own lifetime with HIV/AIDS, with the pandemic flu of 2009, with the SARS, with a variety of other infections, some of which were blips on the radar screen, but some of which had profound global health implications. So we just have to keep pressing home the message on the one hand, but on the other hand, doing the science that would allow us to address these challenges when they do occur.
Hank Greeley, as an educator, how do you assess the level of awareness among your students, among scientists, of this potential threat?
It's not as great as it should be. This is one of the, I think, greatest potential threats that humans face. I think more on the natural side than on the biological warfare side, but the biological warfare side is not trivial. And it's kind of frustrating because we really do have examples, and not just the examples that turned out not to be world-changing, like SARS and like the 2009 flu, but, you know, we're in San Francisco. HIV is 30 years old, and it changed the world in many terrible ways. That was an emerging virus, an emerging disease that was some combination of a pre-existing virus mutating in ways that made it more transmissible and then spreading around the world. So we should remember those problems and be more concerned about support for research that can spot emerging diseases and, you know, presumably, hopefully, stop them.
So does that, in the end, come back to you as an argument for wider publication and dissemination?
Yes, it's an argument for it, but that's the problem with hard questions like this one. They're good arguments on both sides, and it's a powerful argument, and it's an argument that gets thrown into the balance. I think it is appropriately being balanced in all the discussions I've heard about this controversy, and I'm sure that Bruce and Phil Campbell at Nature are balancing away and thinking about it. But ironically, you know, the controversy about this NSABB recommendation has thrown far more attention onto these two studies than they ever would have had before.
So in some ways, it's furthered that goal in an ironic way. Jim writes in, the mere fact that it's now known that the bird flu virus can be altered to increase the rate at which it spreads among humans will increase the funding of research to reproduce the research done in this paper. I would also argue that soon other scientists will publish their own research and provide the techniques for replicating it. I would therefore argue that the full research should be published. Dr. Fauci, what do you think of that argument?
Well, I think, you know, it gets back to the dilemma that we're faced in. We hope, and Bruce and I, you know, are essentially working, literally, we have a phone call this afternoon to try and discuss how best to do that, is to make sure that we address the real concerns of the general public about this information getting into the wrong hands, at the same time that we do not make it difficult for people with a legitimate scientific reason, be they a basic scientist or a public health official in Vietnam or in Indonesia, to get this information in its fullness and completeness in order today so that they can do their jobs. That's the goal that we're trying to do in the next couple of weeks.
And Bruce Alberts, a last word from you. Do you see a way forward in this? Has it formed in your head about what the best course of action for Science Magazine to take would be?
We've been saying all along that we will pay close attention and to the recommendations of the advisory board, providing we are assured that there is a transparent mechanism to get the information where it's needed. And this is where we've been stuck because, you know, this is the first time this has happened. And frankly, the advisory board and related mechanisms weren't prepared for the kind of decision that they made because, of course, we knew that they'd have to get the information out to the right people, and they didn't have that work through. So a good feature of us waiting, two journals waiting, as we are doing, is it's causing this mechanism to be designed by the government. We all agree that in the end we should have an international mechanism. It shouldn't be the U.S. government, and I know that the U.S. government mechanism is certainly going to include international scientists making these judgments, but we have to get it done quickly. And of course, everybody always is putting off these kinds of things until the last moment. And now we're at the last moment.
Bruce Alberts, editor-in-chief of Science Magazine. I wish you good luck in your conversation with Dr. Anthony Fauci this afternoon. Dr. Fauci, the same to you. I wish you a productive conversation. Thanks very much for joining us, Anthony Fauci. Joining us, too, was Michael Spector earlier, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, and here in the studio, Henk Reilly, the director of the Center for Law and Biosciences and law professor at Stanford University's Law School. Henk Reilly, thanks, too. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Amy Machado. Our engineer today is Danny Bringer. Dan Zoll is our senior editor. Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.